abundance of evidence available to us today that absolves Joseph from any responsibility or connection to the abomination that was and is polygamy. He was a man who should be respected and appreciated for the great work he undertook in an attempt to bring a hard-hearted and stiff-necked people back into the presence of God. Seriously consider Joseph's history and his own words. Glimpse into his heart. As you explore this alternate polygamy narrative, you may be surprised by what you find. You may even discover some truth. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
I am surprised by polygamy deniers. I am not surprised by polygamy deniers. Why am I moonlighting my positions? Hey, take it easy, Bruce Willis. Why am I surprised? Well, Joseph Smith being a polygamist himself and teaching others to do it is established. It just is. I don't run into many people who try to argue that I don't have a shirt that says, I'm the one mighty and strong. It's a pretty short discussion. I do have a shirt that says, I'm the one mighty and strong. And I am, but that's its own episode. Why am I not surprised? Some people don't like polygamy, and they really don't like Joseph Smith being a polygamist. The end. It's really as easy as that. And that's fine. But you have to be honest with yourself if you choose that approach. That is apologetics, not history. You can't use apologetic tactics with a translucent veneer of the historical method and call the whole thing history. It's not. This is what kind of drives the two of us a little nuts sometimes. There are a growing number of people who are on this train. If I'm not mistaken, this is now the third time that Lindsay has used a podcasting platform to tackle this.
It's true. I'm obsessed. John Hamer came on during the original Year of Polygamy podcast episode run that we did. And we actually did a panel together with all the Johnnies. John Hatch, John Dinger came on to help the cause. Why do we care? Okay, it's time for all the cards on the table. And it's pretty simple. We don't do this to be pro-polygamy or anti-polygamy. It's not pro-LDS or anti-LDS. It's not pro-restoration movement or anti-restoration movement. We have one card only. We are pro-history and anti-crappy pseudo-history. Boom. Done. Really, though, to get to that position that Joseph either wasn't a polygamist at all, or maybe he was for a short time but then changed his mind, or he did something that later people confuse for polygamy, or he was just an innocent, misunderstood man whose close friends and contemporaries were all secret polygamists against his will, he was just a steel magnolia among the weeds. Doesn't matter. Any of these positions require you to shoot in the general direction of the historical method. Again, just to reiterate, our only dog in this fight, if this even constitutes as a dog, is it's almost hurtful to watch people get sucked into this. It would be like one of our friends messaging us saying, hey, I just read the great book on American history. Have you heard of this Tim Ballard guy and his Lincoln hypothesis? Stabs us right in the feels.
Here's the thing. All of this current Joseph Smith fighting polygamy business definitely is not new. There is absolutely precedent. Time to back up a little bit and figure out the historical context, and you people booing in the back can shut it. Let's talk about Joseph Smith. No, not senior. No, not junior either. We've had enough of him for a minute. Today, the Joseph Smith on the menu is the little guy himself, Joseph Smith III. As you may recall, his dad was killed in 1844. Sorry for the spoiler. That means he's raised mainly by Emma, and she had a mild distaste for polygamy. Again, apologies for the spoilers. Once the reorganization is reorganized in 1860, Joseph Smith III is convinced to be the leader of the movement. He comes out of his corner swinging. This is from his first sermon at a general church conference. Quote, "There is but one principle taught by the leaders of any faction of people that I hold in utter abhorrence. That is a principle taught by Brigham Young and those believing in him. I have been told that my father taught such doctrines. I have never believed it and never can believe it. If such things were done, then I believe they never were done by divine authority. I believe my father was a good man, and a good man never could have promulgated such doctrines." Notice he couldn't even say the P word.
Sounds like mommy taught him to reject the P. See, the thing is that the rejection of polygamy predated the creation of the RLDS Church. When the LDS cousins out in Utah announced to the world their worst kept secret ever, "Hey, in case you have been asleep for the last 10 years, we're doing the polygamy," the RLDS fired back. Isaac Sheen, who had been baptized in Nauvoo, said in an interview, quote, "The Salt Lake Apostles also excused themselves by saying that Joseph Smith taught the spiritual wife doctrine. Joseph Smith repented of his connection with this doctrine and said that it was the devil. He caused the revelation on the subject to be burned," end quote. And then a year later, William Marks added to it. Remember, he had been the stake president in Nauvoo, and since he thought polygamy sucked, he and Emma were pretty tight. Listen to the scene he paints. Quote, "Joseph, however, became convinced before his death that he had done wrong. For about 3 weeks before his death, I met him one morning in the street, and he said to me, 'Brother Marks, I have something to communicate to you.' We retired to a by place and sat down together when he said, 'We are a ruined people.' I asked, 'How so?' He said, 'This doctrine of polygamy or spiritual wife system that has been taught and practiced among us will prove our destruction and overthrow. I have been deceived,' said he. In reference to its practice, it is wrong, it is a curse to mankind, and we shall have to leave the United States soon, unless it can be put down and its practice stopped in the church. Now,' said he, 'Brother Marks, you have not received this doctrine, and how glad I am. I want you to go into the High Council, and I will have charges preferred against all who practice this doctrine, and I want you to try them by the laws of the church and cut them off if they will not repent and cease the practice of this doctrine. And,' said he, 'I will go into the stand and preach against it with all my might, and in this way we may rid the church of the damnable heresy,'" end quote. It's very interesting that both of these dudes admit that Joseph Smith was involved, but he sort of changed his mind. Since they lived through Nauvoo, they didn't have much choice. If you're with your friend and you watch them pick the wedgie and then sniff their fingers, you can't say they didn't do it. You can only claim your friend later admitted that they regretted their decision.
It's the wedgie principle. By the end of the 1860s, the RLDS apostles have a lengthy discussion on polygamy. Their meetings were a little more Robert's Rules of Order and less Brigham telling everyone shit on Congress. One of the quorum puts a resolution, quote, "We do not believe that the revelation, alleged to have come through Joseph Smith, the martyr, authorizing polygamy or spiritual wifery, came from God. Neither do we believe that J. Smith was in any wise the author or excuser of these doctrines." Close quote. They split right down the middle on it. What's fascinating is that these apostles who oppose the resolution do so, quote, "because of the almost universal opinion among the saints that Joseph was in some way connected with it." However, by the 1870s, two developments made Joseph Smith III's route more clear. Some of these dudes who had been in Nauvoo on the ground had died, and his brother, David Hiram, who had clearly been very troubled by this issue, is now in a mental institution where, sadly, he would spend pretty much the rest of his life. Joseph Smith III is now able to plot a course more toward denying his father had any involvement at all with polygamy. Even crazy Uncle William goes to bat for him, arguing in the pages of the Saints Herald that the polygamy revelation was a wicked forgery. I'd say, hey, Smiths, come get your brother, but there weren't many left at that point to come get him.
There you go. Quick and dirty overview of the RLDS position early on. Joseph Smith may have had something to do with polygamy, but repented. That morphs into denying any involvement. Throw in some forgery for good measure, and this was the party line for the next 75 years or so. By the 1950s, though, the ground begins to shift. A few little liberal earthquakes start to rumble. Calm down, comparatively speaking, this is next to nothing. But it spooks some RLDS folks. In 1965, RLDS professor Robert Flanders published the landmark Nauvoo Kingdom on the Mississippi with the University of Illinois Press. He had the audacity, the utter audacity, to say that, holy crap, you guys, Joseph Smith was a polygamist. That didn't go over too well. He is basically marginalized from his community. Wouldn't be the first.
Yeah. It's so interesting because he's that same generation as Arrington, and he's doing kind of the same thing there, but man, he gets beat down even faster than Leonard did for it.
You know, so. I wonder what it would be like to speak publicly about polygamy and have your entire community be upset with you.
Yeah, it'd be so hard to like envision that so you could empathize with him.
Yeah, I can't picture it.
It's tough. Maybe someday. Well, goodness, we got all sorts of scary stuff going on here. If only somebody would step up and champion the cause of traditional conservative RLDS folks. Somebody kind of vaguely mighty and strong. Welcome to the game, Prices. Richard and Pamela Price were the power couple of fundamentalist RLDS circles. Lindsay insisted we called them Pitchard, and I reluctantly agreed, but privately, I will use the term Ramela. You understand. Richard's mother had twice married LDS dudes, so he was well aware of his Utah cousin's perspective on Joseph Smith and polygamy. Ramela were dismayed that their RLDS identity was being eroded away, and they were not going to sit back and take it. Step 1. Publish a book. 1974, they come out with a book entitled Saints at the Crossroads, and it is a laundry list of gripes. The church is turning into just another Protestant church. Our curriculum is written by communists. Ezra Taft kind of smiled at that one approvingly. Joseph Smith is getting crapped on, yada, yada, yada. Richard ominously suggests that God is going to have to, quote, raise up another people to do his work. I told you he smelled mighty and strong. If only he had the shirt.
If he doesn't have the shirt, it doesn't count.
That's
in the Doctrine and Covenants,
I'm
pretty sure.
It's very easy.
In 1983, Richard Howard, and remember his name because he's basically the RLDS Leonard Arrington, published an article about RLDS views on polygamy, and he concedes, yes, Joseph Smith was a polygamist. End of story. Pitchard is pissed. They take out a full-page ad in the Independence Examiner to rebut Howard's article. It was apparently paid for by employees at RLDS headquarters. Yeah, the Prices weren't alone. Plenty of hardliners couldn't believe the butts next to them in the pews on Sunday were giving in. Remember, guys? We've been fighting Salt Lake on this for a minute. Don't give in. They weren't done. Oh no. The following year, it was time to be famous authors again. This time, the book is called The Polygamy Conspiracies. Okay, friends, here's your drinking game for today. Every time you hear conspiracy, you get to enjoy some Porter's Fire cinnamon liquor or root beer, depending on where you sit. Listen to their theme. Here we go. Quote, the group which is trying to prove Joseph Smith Jr. to be polygamist is the present-day liberal element in the RLDS Church. Why are these people pushing the polygamy issue now? The reason is because they are determined to take the RLDS Church into the National and World Council of Churches so it can be part of the New Age movement. In order to do this, they must discard the entire Restoration movement, including the Prophet Joseph Smith.
Women's ordination comes that same year, 1984. Jeez, victories for Satan all around him. Richard, as a result of all this, has his priesthood silenced. I think that's even cooler than excommunication.
What does that mean?
Your priesthood is silenced.
Like before, it's super loud and chatty, and now it just has to like sit quietly. Shh. Oh, sorry.
Your priesthood has to use a primary voice.
That one, I feel like I could kind of relate with.
Yeah, we can get that one. All right, so he gets silenced. Then a few years later, they start up a periodical called Vision. And from the very first issue, they have a column entitled, dun-dun-dun, Joseph Smith Fought Polygamy. Ugh. Did you feel your stomach get kind of pukey there? Sorry, it's all downhill from here. Just to emphasize how important the Price's writing will be for future authors, one of them noted that during his research, he found the Price's stuff, which he called, quote, an oasis in the vast desert of false history.
So wait. So first starts out with, yeah, he did it, but then he like changed his mind. But now it's like he's going into battle to fight this wicked practice.
Yeah, it's so interesting to watch it morph. I mean, yeah, again, once you have guys who watched it happen, you can't say he didn't do it. But once they die.
He did it, but he didn't want to. It's like every time my kids eat their Brussels sprouts.
Poor, you know, big, mean Brigham Young had his arm behind his back saying, you're going to do polygamy.
Eat your vegetables.
Marry your plural wives, Joseph, and then you can have dessert.
Well, we all hear about how Brigham and Joseph didn't want to do it. So.
Oh, yes.
It was basically like eating massaged kale every day.
And what's so interesting on the Brigham thing, we talked about this before, but, you know, that's always been the standard Brigham line is, you know, I would rather be in the grave than be a polygamist. But
John Turner, in Utah, he is like, hello, wives.
Yeah.
Look at all the women you get. The more wives you have, the better of a man you are.
Yeah, it's while they're in Nauvoo, they're kind of dancing the Victorian morals dance. But once they're doing their own thing, we're say goodbye to all that. We're polygamy is the best and monogamists are weird. So, all right, Prices. It's time to dance here. First up in their book is a crash course on Jacob Cochran and his merry band of perverts, the Cochranites. Lindsay suggested we call them something other than Cochranites, and I told her that was not appropriate. Here's the thing. This group really is interesting. And, oh, you've never heard of them? Well, ma'am, you must not have read much in the polygamy denial genre, because the Cochranites are the best.
And you can remember that they put the Runites in Cochranites.
There you go.
That's the word you really want to emphasize.
That's the version of that that you can say while your children are in the room, so... And the Cochranites will make an appearance in basically everything polygamy deniers will write. Because if you insist Joseph Smith had nothing to do with polygamy, you still have to figure out how polygamy got to Nauvoo. Your back is absolutely against the wall on this one. There is no way, flat out, to stick your head in the historical sand on polygamy in Nauvoo.
Hey, you're already butt deep in the sand where Joseph is concerned. Just saying.
We've been over this. You calm down over there. All right, here's how it works. Beginning in 1832, LDS missionaries start working Cochranite territory. For reference, we're up in Saco, Maine. And that's Saco, not Saco, not Saco, unless you want to get the business from the locals. It's their Tooele, we're told.
The Cochranites are in Saco. Okay.
Yeah,
I like where this is going.
Okay, yeah. So you live out in Tooele, I take it.
Yeah, this is like a Beaver Fillmore situation.
Yeah, this is the easiest way to tell people you're not from around here, so... While they're up there, the elders start hearing about this whole Cochranite thing, and it's an interesting group. It's this loose, seekerish group. They've got free love. They've got complex marriage as a frosting on top. Jacob Cochran is in charge of everything. He's the Chad Daybell of the town, if you will. The missionaries, who include Orson Hyde and little brother Samuel Smith, write about it in their journals, including their disgust at all this kinky stuff going down. But they're really successful up there. So in 1835, they have a big conference at which 9 of the 12 apostles are in attendance. Wait, Cochranites are doing the polygamy and the apostles, who do the polygamy later in Nauvoo, are up there? Holy crap, Watson, we cracked the case. This is where Mormon polygamy comes from.
Wait, just because they were there, that's where polygamy gets in the bloodstream? Was Joseph Smith up there? Wait, I'm being told no. Do we have any evidence that the Mormon dudes found the Cochranite stuff compelling?
No. We just talked about that. They talk about in their journals how they thought it sucked. It was gross. It was disgusting.
Is there anything to suggest they tell Joseph Smith about any of this? Wait a minute. What does my Ouija board say? Getting a big thumbs down again. So, do we have anything useful? Wait, let me try the Holy Ghost. Anything to help us make sense of this? Damn, big fat goose egg again. If this leaves you raising an eyebrow, save it, friends. You're going to need all that eyebrow raising energy for later, because this is some really weak nonsense.
Stand tall for the beast of America. Here's the thing. I went to New Mexico a few years ago. I currently have a bottle of Hatch chili sauce at my house. Obviously, Hatch chiles are a New Mexico thing, and therefore I picked up the sauce in New Mexico. That's solid reasoning. No, it's terrible reasoning. I got it at Smith's here in Utah. There's about 9 million other ways that this delicious sauce could have ended up in my cupboard. This is the first time I'm going to hop on the old soapbox today. In denying Joseph Smith's involvement in polygamy, their writing is thoroughly infused with this kind of nonsense. There's an entire field of scholarship on polygamy, and this is your counterpunch? Leap of reasoning after leap of reasoning?
You probably didn't expect a full court press of Cochranites, but I'm guessing you could probably guess that Brigham Young would be a big target if you're trying to prove Joseph Smith's non-involvement. Your guess is, of course, incredibly accurate. Often, the first point out of the gate is that Brigham Young had 56 children with plural wives, but Joseph Smith, bagel, not a single one. And honestly, this really is an interesting question. Now, it's not quite as stark as it sounds. Brigham only had 5 of these children during Joseph Smith's life. Still, though, why no children? You likely remember that we've brought this up a couple of times. We've never really talked about it at any length because there really isn't much to say. There were a couple possibilities for children born to plural wives that were kicked around, but DNA testing has ruled them all out. However, no children equals Joseph Smith never slept with any of these women? That's a little much. All no children proves is that there weren't no children. There are a lot of ways in which this could have happened. If we had any solid evidence for anything, we could talk about it. But no children also backs up the idea that Nauvoo polygamy was a secret. However, don't misunderstand us here. We're certainly no Brigham apologists. I mean, we've literally had shirt designs sent to us featuring my best line so far in the podcast, Brigham had no game. Special thanks to the several people who sent us t-shirts on that. Seriously, we got several t-shirts in the mail. That's kind of fun. I plan to wear them all summer long. Once again, we're not trying to uphold the Brigham Young party line. There's just no evidence that he is responsible for introducing polygamy. Don't give him that credit. He's not that clever.
Another prominent element the writers use is very bold binary statements, and they have good precedent. Often they'll use statements from past figures, especially Smith family members. Check out this sampler plate. Joseph Smith III, quote, "To assert that Joseph Smith was afraid to promulgate that doctrine, polygamy, if the command to do so had come from God, is to charge him with a moral cowardice to which his whole life gives the lie." Alexander Hale Smith, another Joseph Smith son, after discussing the statement on marriage in the 1835 DNC, quote, "But says one, that was only a sham to blind the eyes of our enemies. Shame on the man or set of men who will thus willfully charge the two best men of the 19th century, the two prophets of the Most High God, with publishing to the church and the public at large a lie and signing their names to it." Then, in a section the Price is entitled, "Joseph was either a monogamist or a hypocrite and fraud," they quote Elbert Smith, who was later the presiding patriarch. He was the son of David Hiram Smith, quote, "There is no halfway ground. Either Joseph Smith was true and clean, open and above board, as the reorganized church claims, or else he was a hypocrite and a fraud through and through, as his enemies claim. The Utah Mormons cannot long continue seriously to contend that he was a real prophet of God and a good man, yet blowing hot in private and cold in public, a monogamist in the pulpit and press, and a polygamist in his home." My response to all these is, hold on, fellas, let's all put our quills back in their inkstands. And LDS folks are just as used to this kind of talk. Gordon Hinckley was very fond of statements like this one about the first vision, quote, "Our whole strength rests on the validity of that vision. It either occurred or it did not occur. If it did not, then this work is a fraud." And you know, I get the appeal. Bold is intoxicating. However, it really sets folks up to get smacked upside the head later on. Real life is really a lot less accommodating to these stark either-ors.
I am either the greatest Diet Coke drinker to ever live, or I'm a complete junkie. I can't be both.
I can see some middle ground on that one. I will concede that one.
Part of the problem here is that these authors build an impenetrable barrier between public statements and private behavior. We're talking Berlin Wall level before David Hasselhoff comes onto the scene. And the thing is, if you take only the public Joseph Smith, it's very easy to see how they can deny that Joseph Smith was never involved in polygamy. But again, acting as a historian, you can't do that. The annoying thing is these folks actually do understand how public declarations can be 100% at odds with private actions. One writer summarizes, quote, "The 1890 manifesto did not end polygamy. It was an attempt to fool the United States government into believing that the practice has ended." Oh, even though leaders were consistently saying in public that polygamy was over, in private, it was an entirely different story. Yes, exactly. That's the point. When Mike Quinn came on Year of Polygamy, he brilliantly pointed out that the Joseph Smith era and the demise of polygamy were just mirror images of each other. And if you can't figure out why someone would be wanting to publicly deny a practice that was completely at odds with the Victorian morals of their society, I don't know what to tell you. On the other side of this barrier is the private sector. And that's where it really gets ugly. Because on that side, you have, well, the whole case. The Polygamy Revelation, Joseph Smith's own journal, the William Clayton Diaries, that's quite a pile of evidence. Contemporary, eyewitness, farm-to-table freshness. What do they say about all of this? Here's a sampling, quote, "There is no reliable evidence contemporary with Joseph Smith that proves that polygamy originated with him," end quote. Just for funsies, there's a footnote explaining what contemporary means.
It's very helpful. I was like, contemporary? Is that like Italian? Never heard that word before.
This is very Cardi B, no face, no case. Okay, quote, "No matter the source, not one piece of viable evidence linking Joseph to polygamy originated during his lifetime. Instead, every viable piece of evidence condemning him as the originator of polygamy came forward after his death on June 27, 1844, end quote. Brigham Young changed nearly all doctrine from Joseph's restoration, after which he completely rewrote Joseph's and the church's history while simultaneously changing its narratives so that Joseph and the church's history would fit his new doctrines," end quote. That one's fun. I can't wait to talk about that in the Utah period.
Woof. Just woof at all of this. To describe how statements like this feel to me, let me share with you the parable of In and Out. One day, two dudes pulled into the parking lot of In-N-Out, both headed for the same parking spot, and started arguing. Now, I know what you're already thinking. How the hell do you expect me to believe that two separate people went there on purpose? Do they not know there are other places that have fries that aren't just raw julienne potatoes? I know. It's a hard point to get over. Just ignore that for a second. Let's get back to the parable. The first man, a Pharisee from Orem, roundhouse kicks the other dude, a Samaritan from Sanpete, in the face and knocks him out. Publicans inside In-N-Out come out. They inform the evil Pharisee that they have video surveillance and he's caught red-handed. The Pharisee gets up on his ramiumptum and declares that no evidence of his roundhousing is legitimate. When the publicans ask why, he responds, "Because I don't like that evidence. Makes me look like I just roundhoused that guy." They insist that's not how the world works. Then he roundhouses them all. Then he goes inside and he gets his lettuce wrap, animal, monster, thing, style, or whatever you do there. Now, here's the thing. Bracketing all evidence you don't like and classifying it as bogus doesn't work in parables, and it certainly doesn't constitute history. That just makes for a crappy bedtime story. The apologist who cried fake evidence.
Can I just say, I like to blame all my problems on Brigham Young too, just to be transparent. When there's something I don't like, I usually blame Brigham, so.
Oh, you can't find your socks? Brigham Young invented not finding socks.
I do feel like a lot of the ills in my life can be traced back to Brigham Young, but that will be all later. I wouldn't say polygamy is the one that I would pin on him, though.
No. He didn't make it better.
Brigham had no game.
Okay. All of this In-N-Out talk is hitting my soul in the crotch with a frozen sledgehammer. Back to the real world. What about the most obvious contemporary sources that depict Joseph Smith's involvement with polygamy? The Polygamy Revelation, and William Clayton's Diaries. You would assume that these writers would have to deal with it. Oh, no, they do. Buckle up, kids. And just a note, there are many other contemporary pieces of evidence beyond that. But we figured you probably weren't interested in a 14-hour episode.
First point of attack, the Polygamy Revelation. This is a really tough one to argue against. Why? Well, this revelation is actually better documented than basically any other Joseph Smith text. Quote, "Joseph Smith Journal for July 12, 1843, received a revelation in the office in presence of Hiram and William Clayton. William Clayton Journal. This AM, I wrote a revelation consisting of 10 pages on the order of the priesthood, showing the designs in Moses, Abraham, David, and Solomon having many wives and concubines. Copy of the revelation with a date on it." There you go. Good luck finding that much documentation for other revelations. Yes, it's not the original. We have William Clayton's account that Newell Whitney had a copy made by Joseph Kingsbury, who was the front husband for his daughter, Sarah Ann Whitney. Remember, we talked about her and that whole crazy situation? The copy we have is in Kingsbury's handwriting. The original, according to several later accounts, was destroyed by Miss Emma herself. I think we can all figure out why. Yes, I realized later that Emma denied polygamy and denied ever seeing the revelation. Again, if you can't use your imagination to understand her behavior here, I guess take your imagination to the Apple Store and see if they can troubleshoot it. So, does that make this copy suspect? I hope not, because guess which other revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants we only have copies of. All of them. We don't have the original dictated text for any of them, as far as we can tell.
And one writer really had a little trouble figuring this one out. He quoted William Clayton saying, quote, "I again testify that the revelation on polygamy was given through the prophet Joseph Smith on the 12th of July, 1843, close quote. And then noted he found it, quote, suspect that in his personal journal, William Clayton states, I am ready to testify. Yeah, I would find that suspect too, mostly because that wasn't his journal. This is from a letter in 1871, where he's explaining the background for this 1843 revelation to an RLDS dude. You know, a medium in which you would expect to find language like that. And part of the reason is that this author dude wasn't using the published version of Clayton's journals because, boogeyman, I don't know. He was using an internet transcript, which he then, in turn, totally misread. These are the kind of basic things that are covered in all the real books on polygamy. Do your homework, people.
Seriously, it's like getting your history from a YouTube conspiracy theorist. So
filtered through like a Facebook post or something.
Yeah. There are all sorts of other claims about the revelation. Of course, it's weird that Clayton would write down the original text because Clayton had never acted as scribe before. He was a scribe for a large portion of the Book of the Law of the Lord. Remember that? Back to the idea that Kingsbury making a copy, no one outside of Joseph trusted scribes had ever been asked to make a copy of a revelation before. Again, Joseph didn't ask Kingsbury to make a copy. Newell Whitney did. And in the early years when Joseph was making it rain revelations, people made copies all the time. They would take them on missions, give them to people, etc. That's actually where our earliest known copies of the first revelations come from in some cases. You know exactly what happened here with the polygamy revelation.
And one more head-scratcher with Revelation is this claim, quote, "During Joseph's lifetime, there was no public or private reading or printing of this revelation." Now, you're going to get some pushback on this one from 12 very specific dudes, because on August 12th, 1843, Hiram reads the revelation to the High Council in Nauvoo. In the minutes, it's just referred to as, quote, "teaching from President Hiram Smith." I know it's a little underwhelming. See Victorian ideals. Screaming out loud about polygamy at this time was not a great idea. Why this is so hard to grasp for folks that deny Joseph Smith's involvement is, for me, extremely hard to grasp. Guess who else confirms it? Dudes that supported polygamy later in Utah. Yep, both sides agree the revelation was read to the High Council. Really kind of tough to argue that one away. Other people saw, read, and discussed the revelation in the weeks after it was committed to paper. It's kind of an interesting topic to people.
You know what's so interesting? Whenever we do these, people are like, oh, you know, they just covered the basics. They didn't get into the details. So now we're getting the details. We're showing you the arguments that are given. We're showing you why they don't work. And again, these are just a handful, but hopefully you're smart enough to read the sources outright and understand it. But if you're going to quibble on the details, let's go. Why did love put a gun in my hand? There's a lot of righteous hand-wringing about how the dates of early marriages, like Heber Kimball, are at odds with the alleged revelation. And can we just talk about what is it with Mormons referring to things as so-called and alleged? Did you see that? Like, someone did a video clip on YouTube of prophets and apostles using the word so-called with everything.
Oh, no.
It's brilliant. Look it up. It's so funny.
Mark Peterson loved so-called.
So-called revelation.
A lot of that.
So-called Diet Coke addiction. Yeah, I understand.
So-called.
So-called. They were married before the supposed revelation was given. Dudes, no one has ever claimed plural marriages didn't happen before this revelation. Literally no one. Part of the problem is that there is a lot of attention paid to what B.H. Roberts said in the history of the church. Just a pro tip. Maybe try looking at what historians are doing a little closer to the present than the 1900s.
All right, polygamy revelation, you, sir, are dismissed. On to the Clayton Diaries. Yes, I hear you groaning. I know, we already did 3 whole episodes on them. But they're not just interesting in their own right, they roll right into this discussion today. Just like with the polygamy revelation, there is a lot of talk about them in the Joseph Smith denier literature. Here's a little charcuterie board of examples. Quote, only a few scholars have ever been allowed to see them. Those scholars have reported that most of Clayton's entries are incomplete and that many were added in years after the original event. Clayton kept a journal or notebook throughout the Nauvoo era. Scholars believe that once he settled in Utah, his journals were altered. Scholars and historians do not believe that Clayton's journals are a reliable source of information, mainly because they contain notable inconsistencies. I've had some delicious charcuterie before, but this was ho-hum? Hit me. Talk to me about any actual scholar who has argued William Clayton's diaries are suspect. One name. Anybody. I would think even Tim Ballard is backing away, being like, don't look at me, man. I think they're legitimate. And one odd thing they emphasize is how Clayton jumped around. He'd go back and forth between one physical journal to the other to record entries. Like, this is somehow unusual and then, of course, suspicious. This could not be less unusual. Dudes then did this all the time. Heber Kimball, Brigham Young, Amasa Lyman. I helped a little bit. Signature published, well, all 3 of them, but has recently published Amasa Lyman and shortly Brigham Young. And trying to find the entry in the original is a nightmare because they'll do 6 months in this book and then like 2 weeks in this book and then back to this one. They're all over the board. They did this all the time. There's nothing suspicious about this. I don't know why they did it, but they would just kind of grab whatever book was around them and write their diary in it.
That's literally how I do everything, too. It's a nightmare. See, I was telling someone, if you ever go through my Google Drive, it's going to be like 400 untitled documents with like 3 lines on it.
It's because they're later forgeries in Utah.
Yes.
There you go. Boom, done.
But here's the other odd point. Clayton wasn't Joseph Smith's secretary. It was James Whitehead. Now, anyone who's familiar with Nauvoo is saying, James Whitehead, who the crap is that? There's kind of a reason you haven't heard much about him. He wasn't very important. I mean, I'm sure he was, you know, a sunbeam for Jesus.
His mom liked him.
Right. But he shows up basically nothing close to Joseph Smith. So what about him is so interesting to these writers? Let's consult his biography. 1865. Baptized into RLDS Church. Aha. This all makes a lot more sense now. He later will adopt much of the same approach that Emma and Joseph III take. His claims about having Joseph Smith's private records that he resisted handing over? Nonsense. He wouldn't have had anything cool. Friends, I did you a solid. If Brian would have had his way, the rest of this episode would have just turned into reading every paragraph of all of these books and then dissecting it. The compromise solution? Lightning round.
One of the oddest elements in all these books is the following question. How is Emma to be blamed for this? How could she possibly be responsible for this mess? She isn't, dude. Literally no one ever has tried to blame Emma for this.
Well, I mean, I guess Brigham did, but in a different way.
But not like for making Brigham introduce polygamy or something. I mean, it's just, don't bring Emma into this. That's not cool.
It isn't all bad. One of the writers refers to the angel with a flaming sword as Fred.
I cracked up when I read that.
Like, what? Why? Like, where did that?
He's like, I'm not going to keep referring to him as Angel with a flaming sword. I'm just going to call him Fred from now on.
He gave him the name Fred?
I was like, that's a solid move, dude. That's something I would have
done. Like, he didn't even try to do the Mormon thing where we try to, like, appropriate minor Spanish
culture.
He's
probably like Fred Pulsifer or something, or, you know.
You tell me that now every time you hear about the angel coming to Joseph, flaming sword drawn, commanding him to do the polygamy, you're not going to think of him as Fred. You're welcome. And here I was visited by an angel with a flaming sword, and he said, hi, I'm Fred. Nice to meet you.
If you're ever in the Church Museum of Art and you see a depiction of this and underneath it's Joseph Smith with Fred, you're welcome to laugh. Please tell me that it's there too, because I want to see
it. Fred and his flaming sword. Someone put that on a shirt, please. Like, nobody will understand, but it'll be insider speak to podcastites.
It'd be a good Heimerdinger book, right? Adventures of Fred and the Flaming Sword.
Fred and the Flaming Sword could be a gay erotica novel, too. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no one's going to argue that one. All right. There is a complete and utter disgust for the Joseph Smith papers in this literature. One guy chooses instead to use Scott Follering's edition of the Joseph Smith Diaries. And, you know, I don't get this. And this is nothing against Follering. Remember, we talked about him in the Clayton episodes. He did an amazing job with what he had. What he had was a microfilm. And that didn't even have the Book of the Law of the Lord. It wasn't available at that point. And you remember, we talked about that in an earlier episode. And you're, of course, you're thinking at this point, like, dude, instead of pooping your pants about how the Book of the Law of the Lord is in the clutches of the First Presidency, why don't you just go look at it on the Joseph Smith paper site? Like, here's the scan. Here's the transcript. It's totally available. You know, you don't need to write this nonsense.
I hope you like learning who paid their tithing on what day and to who and how much.
Oh, that book is very interesting. And, you know, I will not understand what is so scary about this project. High-res scans and meticulous transcripts aren't scary. That's like saving you all this time. It's great. And it's not like Scott Follering has footnotes that say, William Clayton, that filthy lying bastard, forged so many documents in his life. Like, he's not on board with this. He matter-of-factly discusses polygamy in the footnotes. Oh well, I guess he's not one of these piles and piles of unidentified scholars and historians that are so suspicious about Nauvoo-era documents.
I'm tired of referring to him by that. I'm just going to call him Carl. Can we do that?
Yeah, it's Carl. Didn't, you know, Carl did X.
There are constant rants against official LDS history. Yeah, no kidding. Please see, I don't know, most of our episodes. I hate to break it to you, but institutionally sponsored publications don't enjoy a great reputation for transparency and historical rigor. Of course, just in case we haven't made this clear, with a giant asterisk by the Joseph Smith papers, that's an entirely different animal. And again, with my apologies to everyone from Richard Price down to the present day, anti-polygamy stuff in early RLDS periodicals and such can be lumped right in there too.
Yeah, it's, you know, official LDS history is garbage, but anything in the pages of the Saints Herald that Joseph Smith III said.
Did you know that Joseph Smith Papers Project was funded by Larry Miller? And I'm pretty sure that he believes in Brigham Young, so.
Hold that Utah Jazz thought here for just like 2 seconds. This one writer repeatedly talks about how dysfunctional Utah society is as a result of this manipulated history and polygamy. Now, that's not a bad point.
I mean, we are a mess. That's fair.
That's not a bad point, yeah. But then he goes on to talk about how, quote, even the Utah Jazz seem to be caught up in the rut.
Oh, here we go.
A, you're probably going to have to do a new edition of your book after the playoffs this year. And B, what the absolute hell does this have to do with anything?
When I read that one. You really said this? The Utah Jazz?
Yes. Okay. This is the one I messaged you about when I read it. And you were like, no, it doesn't talk about the Jazz. I'm like, it does. I don't know why, but it does. And, you know,
too far for Brian. That was where you really crossed the line.
I was like, okay, I understand rabbit holes and tangents, but good night. And this episode was a while in coming, partly because these books on the topic are massive. And this is one of the dangers of self-publishing. And see, that's the thing. All of these books were self-published. That alone should tell you something. Because without editors, or at least an honest friend in your life, so much of what you write has to be filed under useless, inexplicable tangent.
Another one of my favorite claims involves a truly impressive leap in reasoning. Think back in time to an earlier era when we talked about the church in New York and how several revelations talked about how they would go to the Ohio.
I love that phrase.
I do. Go to the Ohio. Oh, I'm going to the Ohio. I know, that feels like forever ago. And one of those revelations dated in January of 1831, it says, I say unto you that the enemy in the secret chamber seeketh your lives. I see you nodding your head. You're already ahead of the game. Of course, this must refer to the conspiracy that Brigham Young, Heber Kimball, William Clayton, and company will put together 10 years later in Nauvoo to introduce polygamy and then have Joseph Smith killed to cover it up. Oh, wait, no, you were just scratching your ear. Sorry. And now you have that what the crap are you talking about look on your face. And I am with you. This really is a jump. This is such a weird argument to read. After pulling this out of their metaphorical asses, the author constantly refers to the secret chamber, capitalized, of course, because we like Harry Potter, and their doings like it's a real thing. Not something he just completely made up. If I decide to privately call myself Her Majesty Kickass III and then later ask you, hey, what was your opinion of Her Majesty Kickass III at karaoke the other night? You would legitimately respond, what exactly are you talking about? You can't make up something and then keep referring to it like it's some established fact in history. It's so weird.
It was so great. You know, the at one point, Brigham Young is the secret chamber master. Again, all capitalized. Like
Fred and his Chamber of Secrets.
It's all real.
The new Heimerdinger book.
It's an established title that people recognize. So part of this claiming that the secret chamber was always just kind of doing their own thing, one of the authors brings up the missionaries in England in 1840, again, think back to that episode, and how they allegedly wrote letters to Joseph Smith and Nauvoo asking for counsel. But when they didn't get a response, they went ahead and made executive decisions. Well, this author isn't having it, arguing, quote, "At this time in history, it was only possible to get one, maybe two letters from England to America and back over a five-month period, not several." They weren't getting letters back in England. That's kind of the point of this whole story. If you don't get responses, you can write 75 letters a day and they'll all make it there within 5 months. Then this author makes more characteristic leaps off the cliff. First, they indignantly demand to know where these letters are. Quote, "The modern church must now produce these letters that Brigham claims he sent over this five-month period, i.e. one of them had to make its way into the archives." Ugh. All right, let's put on our patient hats, the one we use when our kids are in meltdown mode. Sweetie, it's okay. They're all there in the archives. One was published in the Times and Seasons. That one's been available for 180 years now. The second was copied into one of Joseph Smith's letter books. Anyone wearing a shirt and shoes, presumably pants, could go into the archives and ask to see it. The third is available in the original. Ditto for the archives. Or, you know, skip the shirt and shoes and just look at all of them on the Joseph Smith Papers site. But, saving the best for last, the author concludes, quote, "Here's their logic. We tried to communicate several times with church headquarters, but they wouldn't answer us. Therefore, we are going to proceed whether it is right or wrong. The question at hand is, what is the subject matter that needs authorization and clarification that is right or wrong? In that every one of these apostles in England became avid polygamists and defenders of it, they were most likely practicing it along with their subordinate William Clayton." Now, if you're left wondering, isn't there like a less ridiculous take on this? Of course. Absolutely. If you actually read the three letters, they're asking about printing editions of the hymn books and the Book of Mormon in England. I get it. That's a letdown. That's not even a tiny bit sexy. Actually, Joseph Smith wasn't super happy with Brigham Young for these printing projects and kind of got after him. And Brigham was like, "Hey man, you never gave us an answer." You know, the exact story these stupid historians were describing in their boring, vanilla, non-conspiratorial manner.
But how are we going to drink more root beer if we don't have more conspiracies?
That's a good point. I want my Porter's Fireball.
Okay, one last example of the secret chamber business. Another claim is that, along with polygamy, dudes not named Joseph Smith were responsible for introducing temple stuff. This is buttressed by several things like Joseph rarely called the Kirtland Temple a temple. So, take a shot, conspiracy. It's true that he didn't always call it a temple, but newsflash, the temple in 1836 wasn't the temple in 2021. The author also demands eventually the church will have to admit this. Already done that, my friends. There is an entry in Joseph Smith's journal where he meets in the temple, but it's crossed out. Now, get all the beverages out of your mouth so you don't spit take in shock. It was crossed out because he refers to meeting with the presidency, which clearly meant the temple presidency, which didn't exist yet. And so later on, the church would have seen this history fixing error and therefore would have been forced to cross it out. Wait, wait, are you handing me a razor? Occam's razor? I've never said it out loud, just read it on Facebook arguments. Occam's razor? Ah, I see. There must be some other utterly obvious solution. What other kind of presidency could it have been? Maybe the first presidency? Maybe even the same first presidency that he meets with in the first 13 words after the crossed out part? That seems like a reasonable, anti-nonsensical conclusion.
Then finally, when the apostles are in England, they occasionally do foot-washing rituals, which obviously is a glaring example of the Cochranite stuff that the secret chamber dudes brought into Mormonism. You know, I mean, there's no way it could just be like the same kind of foot-washing they had done in the School of the Prophets and in the Kirtland Temple that people called a temple occasionally at the time. This is not like...
Yeah, but they were doing it in their secret chamber. Their foot-washing. Their Mormon Illuminati.
where they were just wild wives all day long.
All conspiracy all the way down. And you listeners, of course, you've already heard the on the episodes, you know, we've done, you already have the smug look on your face. Good for you. All right, okay. Just one last thing here on the topic. Brigham Young's journal records him being there in Nauvoo in May 1842 when the endowment is first administered. This author fires back indignantly with, quote, "If this grand event constituted the first time in these last days that these new core doctrines were taught, then Joseph and or his scribes would have noted it. And yet, there are no entries for either May 4th or May 5th, 1842 in Joseph's journals." All right, deep breath here. It is my solemn duty to report that, huge spoiler here, there are, of course, entries for both days in Joseph Smith's journal. Guess what they describe on May 4th? The endowment. Guess where one might see said entries? Perhaps on the Joseph Smith Papers site? In Dean Jesse's book that's been in print for like 25 years? And in all seriousness, if you can't handle basic tasks like determining whether Joseph Smith's journal exists for a certain day, writing books for grown-ups might be above your pay grade.
And in talking about this today, we didn't even mess with the later stuff. All the affidavits by the women who were married to Joseph Smith. And later yet, their testimony when they were getting grilled during the Temple Lot suit. And it actually pisses me off that, like, that argument wasn't enough for them. But, you know, I said, we need to believe women. And they're like, why don't you believe Emma? Well, because we actually know Emma lied about several things on this particular topic several
times. But we get why she did it, though. Like,
it's, of course.
We use our imaginations and we can totally see where it's coming from.
It's not because we don't believe them, because we do. Or because we don't think that their, you know, later stuff is interesting. It is. And trust us, we will definitely talk about them later. This was plenty of stuff for today as it is. Just to reiterate, from a historical point of view, denying that Joseph Smith did the polygamy while encouraging others to do the polygamy is simply ridiculous. Or as we say in Utah, ridiculous. Now, shifting to a gentler mode. When you come to this topic believing that Joseph Smith was a prophet and therefore he could not have been involved in something that you find repulsive, it's tough. Trust me. Trust me. I understand. Like dozens and dozens and dozens of blog posts and episodes and interviews and Facebook threads worth. I understand. But working through it with a rigid belief that is unwilling to accept the facts of history is perhaps not the healthiest approach.
Beep beep. Spooks Mormons coming through. There is a healthy and seemingly ever-growing amount of material published with the intent of demonstrating Joseph Smith wasn't part of the polygamy scene. And you're certainly welcome to go check it out, but please know, going into it, you're not really reading history. This is apologetic material with a history glaze. Yeah, there's some footnotes sometimes, there's some references to documents. It's not history. I hope today, as we've talked about this, you can see the problems here. All right, now, one more plug for the Joseph Smith Papers. And, you know, there's really no need to be scared or suspicious. It's an incredible resource. Here's the document. Here's the transcript. It would be difficult to be more transparent. Lots of great books also. We've talked about them so many times now. Houseful of Females, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. In Sacred Loneliness, Todd Compton. Mormon Polygamy, Richard Van Wagener. More Wives Than One, Catherine Danes. Mormon Enigma, Linda King Newell, Val Tippetts Avery, etc., etc., etc. There is literally an entire field of people writing good, solid things. Brian Hill's trilogy. I mean, all of this stuff that people have written. Wonderful stuff. Please go enjoy. It's fantastic.
Forgeries, all forgeries.
All later forgeries in Utah.
Here's the thing. I know people don't appreciate my smugness on this, but I mean, I really did invest, I don't know, a decade of my life now to this topic. And again, it's so weird to see people who have this cursory reading of the text pick and choose things to make themselves comfortable. Kind of makes me mad. Guess what? It's uncomfortable. Join the rest of us. Get in this complex, murky pool of being uncomfortable, because that's what history is. It's uncomfortable.
And again, we just like good history. That's it. We're not pro theological position A or B. That's not part. We just like history that's well done. That's it.
Yeah, listen, of all people, I wish polygamy, Joseph Smith didn't dabble in it, if you will. I wish Fred with a flaming sword didn't show up on his door, but here
Screw
we are.
Screw Fred.
And on that note, I hope you all join us at Sunstone this summer, July 28th through the 31st, 2021. in Sandy, Utah, at the Mountain America Expo Center. We have our big conference, our Mormon Comic Con, and buying a ticket, even if it's just a digital ticket where you get access to all the sessions, you know, remotely, will support us and support this podcast. Sunstone is completely run off donations, and I would like to pay our staff and our podcasters and, you know, maybe buy Brian a Diet Coke now and again. So come to Sunstone.
I don't have an addiction, though. So-called.
Really, you're just funding my... out there, Carolyn Pearson's like, that's it, I'm canceling my subscription. She's well, always trying to get me to drink water.
We'll just
She's
label
so
it
lovely.
Water again like we did.
I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother young, and let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother young, and let my breast be cut asunder, brother young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother young, a blood atoning for my sinning, brother young, 'cause I sin so gravely, brother Brigham, brother young, I sin so gravely, brother young, let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.